It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Over the years, he acquired the unofficial title as the Keeper of the Hope Diamond. That's an iconic 45-carat blue gemstone. And after decades working for the Smithsonian, mineralogist Jeffrey Post is retiring to his beloved Wisconsin. We explore precious gems and minerals, and you can join the conversation. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jeffrey Post is recently retired, a curator in charge of gems and minerals at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. Jeffrey, welcome to the Ideas Network. Welcome back to Wisconsin.
Hey, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you this morning.
Yes.
And I should just say, I'm not actually back in Wisconsin. I was back in Wisconsin last week, but right now I'm in the Washington, D.C. area. But we are planning our return back to that state.
Perfect. Perfect. We'll take that. You retired in May. We got wind that you're coming this way. Why retire to Wisconsin?
Well, it's still home. My wife and I both grew up in the Madison area, and we spent summers there with our family, visiting my parents, and I still have sisters and family and nieces and nephews there. And so, every time I get off a plane or we drive home, it's home once we're back in Wisconsin. So we're kind of looking forward to being home again.
Oh, what a homecoming. I love to hear that. Why turning to your to your profession? Why are people so fascinated by gems?
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? I think it's there's a lot of reasons. I mean, gems have a lot of different appeals to people. I mean, in some cases, it's just looking at them and saying, what a beautiful thing, right? They are gorgeous. There's also the fact that gems are permanent. Unlike if you look at a flower, it looks beautiful, but a few days later, it's faded, it's gone. A gemstone's going to keep that beauty basically forever. And so I think we're kind of fascinated by something that has that that perpetual permanence of beauty. And then, of course, they're valuable, and most of them come with a story. Every time I put a gemstone in someone's hands, it seems the first thing they ask is, who owned this? Where did it come from? And so I think we associate them with interesting people, with history, and all of those things together just make them fascinating to us.
How do you handle them or clean them? Do they need to be cleaned when they're behind glass?
Oh, they do. It's funny. We, as much as we think we've got airproof or dustproof cases with tens of thousands of people coming through our exhibits every day, it seems dust finds its way in. And so it's a perpetual problem. We're always opening cases. And, we have, the same kinds of cloths probably used for cleaning off your glasses or other sensitive optical materials. We're wiping them. Sometimes we dunk them in a little bit of water and clean them off and put them back out. Because one thing we've learned is if the gems don't look absolutely sparkling, our visitors let us know pretty quickly.
What are your favorite minerals or gems from the gems exhibit at the Smithsonian?
Oh, that's a tough one, right? A colleague of mine once used to like to say, I've never met a mineral I didn't love. And I guess I'm a little bit in the same category. But, any given day, I could go out into the exhibit and I could point to something and we could start talking about it. And that might be my favorite for the day. But it is hard to get past the fact that the Hope Diamond has taken up a huge amount of time and attention from the time I started working at the Smithsonian. It is a diamond that gets a lot of attention, has a lot of fascination for people. And it's still pretty amazing to me that you look at this 1-inch diameter blue diamond and think of all of the history, all of the stories, all of the books, the movies, everything that's been done, the thousands of people that come each day to see this. And you got to kind of look at it and you go, wow, that's pretty amazing. This one diamond has caused such a stir and has gotten so much attention.
I think I know what's going through your mind as you clean it. Jeffrey Post with us, mineralogist, recently retired from the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, as we talk about one of the largest collections of gems and minerals. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Join in with your questions or your comments. Can you talk a little bit about that history of the Hope Diamond and the lore of this 45-carat blue diamond?
Sure. The quick version, because it can go on for a long time, is it's a diamond that was found in India in the late 1600s. It was sold to King Louis XIV of France. It became part of the French crown jewels. During the French Revolution, it was stolen from the French crown jewels. And the recut version of that stone, which is the Hope Diamond, appeared for sale in London in the early 1800s. It became part of the collection of Henry Philip Hope, who was a banker who had a great gem collection. And it's the Hope family name, of course, that goes with the diamond today. And then eventually one of his descendants was forced to sell the diamond, and it changed hands several times, but ultimately was purchased by a woman who lived in Washington, D.C. Her name was Evelyn Walsh McLean. And it was really about the time that she bought the diamond that people started talking about, you know, the fact that maybe there was a curse or bad luck on this diamond. And in part, it was a story to help get the diamond some attention to help sell it. But also, once it was owned by this very famous and wealthy woman, you know, she liked to tell the stories. And then a few unfortunate things happened in her life. She lost a son at an early age, a daughter committed suicide. And so people who like to believe in bad luck said, well, gee, look at all the terrible things happening to this wealthy lady who owns this diamond. And of course, the diamond got the blame for all those things.
Is it true when it was donated to the Smithsonian, it was sent through the post office, through the mail?
Well, so after Evelyn Walsh McLean passed away in 1946, her collection, including the Hope Diamond, was sold to Harry Winston, the jeweler in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And he traveled the diamond around the United States as part of what he called his Court of Jewels exhibit. So a lot of people had a chance to see it. It got a lot of attention. And then he decided in 1958 to donate the diamond to the Smithsonian. And certainly it was good publicity for him, but also he had this vision that we should start a great national gem collection. He said, even though we don't have a crown jewels, a king and a queen, we should have our own national gem collection. So he donated the diamond, and being a little bit, you know, the salesman, the flamboyant jeweler, you know, he didn't just quietly put it in his pocket and bring it down to Washington, D.C. and say, here it is. No, he put it in the mail and insured it for $1 million. And it was then delivered by a postman to the museum the next day. A bunch of people were waiting in the gallery for the mailman to arrive, and it was unwrapped and immediately put on exhibit. And so it was just kind of a fun way to introduce this diamond to everybody in the United States and say, here it is at the Smithsonian.
I'm glad it arrived safely. Let's talk a little bit about the glow. It glows orange under UV light. Why is that?
Well, you know, the diamond, in addition to being a fabulous gemstone, is also a really interesting mineral, a really interesting diamond. And the diamond is a blue color. The blue color is because of trace amounts, parts per million, of the element boron. And so the fact that it's blue made it a very intriguing diamond in itself, and one of the reasons why it's rare and valuable. But in the 1960s, scientists studying it realized that when you expose the diamond to ultraviolet light in a dark room and then turn off the ultraviolet light, it would glow a bright orange. And it's pretty bright. It's a property called phosphorescence, and it would glow for about a minute. And so for people who like to believe in curses are going, wow, this is even better than I could imagine. You know, here's this diamond that's supposedly cursed, and it glows a blood red color when you put an ultraviolet light on it. Well, we were curious to know what causes that. And so we've actually done some measurements in the last few years. And with modern spectrometers and things, we're able to determine that, in fact, it's the same impurity, boron, that gives it the blue color that also causes this phosphorescence. So it's not the curse. It's actually a very interesting scientific property of the diamond that causes it to do this.
Is it the phosphorescence that then gives it the glow even when the lights go out after a minute?
That's it. I mean, basically, when you expose the diamond to ultraviolet light, it excites electrons, and when you turn off the light, those electrons lose their energy. They drop back to a lower energy state, and they give off that excess energy in the form of that orange-red light that is the phosphorescence glow.
Jeffrey Post, former curator in charge of gems and minerals at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. You can be part of the discussion about rare gemstones. Call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the legendary Hope Diamond and other famous stones on display at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. The curator of the museum's gems and minerals is set to retire to Wisconsin. And we have mineralogist Jeffrey Post here answering your questions. Let's bring in Lisa in Milwaukee. Hi, Lisa. What is your question?
Good morning. Hey, I was thinking the other day about this. Does it concern you or anyone when you deal with real diamonds that so many of the, I call them GMO diamonds that are being sold today are replacing the real diamonds? And I do not like to be fake. You know what I mean? If I want something, I really want it to be real. So I was just wondering, does that concern you about the, does it take from the real diamonds?
Lisa, thank you. Are you talking about like growing diamonds in the lab?
Yes.
Jeffrey, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And it has really caused some interesting issues within the whole diamond market. I think everyone is still trying to figure out what the impact of lab-grown diamonds is going to be on the sales of natural diamonds in terms of what consumers are told and what they're interested in buying. And so far, lab-grown diamonds have gotten a lot of attention. And, they are actual diamonds. They're just grown in a factory or laboratory as opposed to grown in the earth. And so in terms of their structure, their mineralogy, they're exactly the same. So they are real diamonds. The difference is they didn't come out of the earth. And so for some people, that makes a big difference. They want a diamond that form naturally in the earth and everything, all the story that goes with that. Others just want something that's big and glittery and maybe at a slightly lower price. And so for them, a lab-grown diamond may be the perfect choice. And I think that's what's playing out right now in the industry, and no one quite knows how it's going to work. But there's no doubt there are more and bigger lab-grown diamonds out there, and the price has dropped, and everyone's trying to figure out what part of the market niche they're going to be occupying.
Lisa, thank you for calling in. Jeffrey, what makes a gem or mineral worthy of being featured in the Smithsonian's collections?
There are a number of factors that we consider. First of all, we are looking for gemstones or minerals that are representative of what has come out of the earth that may have an interesting story to tell. Nowadays, we're looking for gems or minerals that might add something new to the collection. We're always looking for something that is really spectacular in terms of beauty or that has a great story to go along with it. And so each opportunity to add something to the collection is sort of a thoughtful discussion amongst my colleagues and myself. And, does it fit in the collection? Is it something we can tell a story about? Is it something the public will find interesting?
Let's go to Tim in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Yeah, I was curious to know what the rarest gem is, what it's made out of or how it was formed, and what makes it so valuable.
Thank you, Tim.
Well, Tim, okay, that's a good question. You know, the answer to what is the rarest gem has changed over time as, you know, various new deposits are discovered. Something that was thought to be very rare, suddenly a new discovery makes it less rare. For example, there's a gemstone that came out of Burma many years ago that is called pudretite. And it was the only gemstone of that. It's only one example of that known. And so for a long time, it was considered to be the rarest gemstone. And then once people realized what it was, they started looking for it in other deposits and in fact did find some. It's still very rare, but less rare than it was. Likewise, is another gem. If you look up online, what is the rarest gemstone? Often what you'll hear is a mineral called painite. And again, the same thing. When they were looking for other gems, they found this one unknown crystal in there, and somebody cut it into a gemstone, realized it was this very rare mineral, and so that became the rarest gem. Well, now since then, they found other examples. So a lot of what makes a gemstone rare is, how many of them are known, but also in some cases, it's a particularly large example of a certain gem that makes it rare, or something that's just particularly beautiful. So all of these different attributes can make something rare and valuable. It just depends on the gemstone.
The history, the story, the science all coming together there. Let's go to Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So, Dr. Post, I was wondering if you noticed during your time at the Smithsonian if there's any type of universal structure to gems and minerals. Like, I mean, I'm not talking about the composition of the elements, but the actual shape that they configure in.
So, Marcus, that's an interesting question. I mean, all of gems and minerals have a unique structure, which is what makes them the particular gem they are, a beryl or a diamond or a corundum or ceph. All of those have their own unique atomic structure. And so there's not any one structure pattern that is common or that links all different kinds of gems. However, once they're cut and polished, there's a lot of, you know, certain shapes that are very typical or common to all the different gems because they best show off the optical properties or the beauty of the stones. So cutters have imposed sort of a uniform look or structure on a lot of these gems, but what nature produced initially, each one has its own unique structure, its own unique sort of configuration, and that's what makes it what it is.
What about like I think it's the Oppenheimer that's uncut versus
yes.
one that is cut, like the Hope Diamond. What would be a difference there?
Well, the Oppenheimer diamond, it's, you know, that's our largest diamond crystal in the collection. It's 254 carats, so a big diamond crystal. And it's shaped, they call it octahedral shape. You imagine two pyramids stuck base to base. So it has eight sides to it. And it's a beautiful thing as it is. And that's the crystal that came out of the earth. And of course, to be cut into a gemstone, a gem cutter would then start with a crystal like that and would shape and facet it to produce the shape that we're familiar with in cut diamonds that best reflects light and shows off the beauty of the diamond. And so when you make that transformation, it goes from being a mineral crystal to now being a gemstone. And once it's a gemstone, of course, we think about it in all different ways than we ever did as a crystal.
Interesting. Jeffrey Post, mineralogist, recently retired as curator in charge of gems and minerals at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your question. Jeffrey, Connor from Fort Atkinson called in, and Connor is wondering your thoughts on the Eagle Diamond that was at the American Museum of Natural History before it was stolen. The gem was discovered in Eagle, Wisconsin.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of a sad story, isn't it? That one of the great diamonds that came out of Wisconsin. And, you know, there have been a number of diamonds found in Wisconsin, almost always in gravel deposits. So probably as the result of glaciers moving those diamonds maybe from Canada down into Wisconsin at some point. But that particular diamond, which is one of the most well-known ones from the state, was, of course, featured on display at the Natural History Museum in New York. And in 1964, I think it was, they had a theft of their gems. The thief got some notoriety. He was known in the newspapers as Murph the Surf. He was a beach bum sort of that became a gem thief. And a number of the major stones that were stolen at that time were eventually recovered, found in a bus locker in Miami. But unfortunately, the diamonds that were stolen, almost none of them were found again. And the trouble with diamonds, of course, is they can be recut so they don't look like they did before, or a rough diamond like the Eagle Diamond could be cut. And once it's been cut and put into the back into the market, you just don't recognize it again. So unfortunately, as far as we know, that diamond has been lost, and probably once it was stolen, was immediately sold, recut, and I'm afraid we'll probably never see it again.
Well, in retirement, very quickly here, will you be able to spend some time at Cave of the Mounds or other places to get your minerals on?
Well, my wife and I are looking forward to exploring much of the state of Wisconsin. It's probably one of the big incentives. You know, there's so much interesting and beautiful to see in Wisconsin. And we're looking at, you know, being somewhere in the Madison area, partly because I'm hoping to keep some connection there with the university and a chance to still do a little bit of research and, you know, get to spend time with colleagues there. But also, I will probably be popping back and forth to the Smithsonian every once in a while to finish up some projects there and the nice thing is that there are minerals everywhere. And so there will not be a shortage of things to look at. And one of the things that I think my wife is still getting used to realizing is that what I did for my profession most of my life is also what I enjoy doing for my hobby. I don't think I'm going to stop enjoying gems and minerals just because I'm retired. And so it is one of the fun parts of looking forward to being in Wisconsin.
All the best to you. Jeffrey Post, recently retired as curator in charge of gems and minerals at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers take air samples along Lake Michigan in Kenosha County to measure ground-level ozone, the pollution that's created when the fuel burned in vehicles and factories and power plants, it mixes with hot, sunny days. We learn about the elevated readings in this area and potential sources, and you can join the conversation about air quality. Call in with a question or your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Todd McKinney is a researcher for Rocket City Ozone Quality Evaluation in the troposphere at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, part of a multi-state and federal agency project monitoring ground ozone in southeast Wisconsin and over Lake Michigan. Todd, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So take us into this project. You're involved in a month-long ozone monitoring project, and you're using balloons and drone and a plane. And the choice of the area is the Shewaukee Prairie State Natural Area near Pleasant Prairie. What is the scope of this project?
Yeah, so ozone, if you don't know, is a what we call a secondary pollutant, right? So everyone thinks of ozone as being in the stratosphere, right? You've heard the ozone layer. But people really don't realize that ozone up high is great. You know, it blocks solar radiation. But ozone in the troposphere is actually a really bad pollutant that has, if it's high enough, can cause really bad respiratory problems. So one of the main reasons why we're here along the lakeshore is all that pollution that can come off from Chicago, we call it the Chicago plume, can be blown north over the lakeshore where there's not a lot of people, right? And then when the sun comes up and you get what's called a lake breeze effect, so you have different temperature surfaces, so the cold water, and then over the land, it's much warmer, and you get this circulation. So all that pollution that's been sitting over the water is then blown on shore because of that nice circulation, and you have all that pollution that's been, like you said, cooking with the hot temperatures and mixing and producing ozone is blown on shore, and now everyone's air quality just goes way, way down. We saw this 2 days ago, actually. Probably people might have saw a air quality alert go out where I think we've had the highest ozone ever recorded, or very close to it, here on the lakeshore. And in that case, 2 days ago, we had the worst ozone exceedance in the country.
Wow.
So it's a really interesting place to be to measure ozone production and look at all the chemistry.
And this is happening as you're conducting these samples. Are these conditions helpful for your research, or is this just like a coincidence?
Oh, it's, yeah, this is why we're here. You know, the lake breeze effect has been observed for a very long time in the high ozone production off the coast of Kenosha and blowing on shore. We've seen it a lot, so that's why we're here, and that's why a lot of these federal agencies are coming up here to do these studies, because what we define as poor air quality is if the air quality exceeds a certain value, right? So the EPA sets exceedances that you can't go over, right? Mm. So if you're in a really polluted city and they have a lot of exceedance days, they basically say, hey, well, we got to do something about it. We have to investigate who is causing this higher pollution, right? So to lower it to, you know, help improve the health of the public. But it's kind of hard to do, right? Because if you're in Wisconsin, right, and you're on the lakeshore, right, who's liable if your air quality goes down? Is it the local area? Is it Chicago? Or, as everyone's probably seen, is it the Canadian wildfires that are blowing all that PM2.5 and smoke over the state? So trying to figure out the solution for air quality is very difficult. And that's one of the main reasons why we actually come out here as air quality scientists, is to say, well, is it a local issue? You know, is there some local area that's causing higher pollution that can, you know, lower the air quality? Or is a larger scale issue? Do we have large scale transport like smoke fires, or like I was just talking about before with the Chicago plume, right? Who needs to improve their air quality to, you know, lower the exceedance days for where we're measuring?
Is this, I'm curious, is this the first time you've measured ground level ozone in Wisconsin?
Yes, this is actually the first time the UAH team has actually been out here.
University of Alabama in Huntsville. Carry on. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is the first time we've actually been out here to participate in this campaign, but they've been doing a lot of these lake breeze ozone studies. In 2017, they had the Lake Michigan ozone study, which kind of found a lot of things we're seeing now, but you know, it seems like every study always opens up more questions. So that's why we're back to help out. In the rocket truck, you know, that long acronym you just gave, we just call it Rocket. That has an ozone LIDAR. That's the biggest thing. And an ozone LIDAR allows you to get profiles from the ground, around the ground level, all the way up to the troposphere of ozone. So we know the mixing ratios of ozone all the way up in that whole atmospheric column. We also do, like you said, balloon launches, because the meteorology is very important with air quality. And understanding how temperature and moisture changes with altitude, how is that pollution either going to be trapped at the surface where everyone's breathing, or is it going to stay aloft, right? So we won't, you know, won't be on the surface breathing all that stuff in. So we also are trying to do drone flights to measure air quality with little sensors. And of course, we have a CRE aircraft, which is a pretty unique platform that allows our air quality instruments to get really low to the water. To measure both ozone, PM2.5, and NO2. So it's a very useful platform. It can fly much lower than other airplanes.
Have you hitched a ride on one of those planes flying super low over the water?
my boss flies it, and I tell you, the pilot seat is him, and the right seat is all the instruments.
Oh,
so there's
wow.
No room. Yeah.
Todd McKinney with us, graduate student at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, part of an ozone monitoring research project now underway in southeast Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions about air quality and ground ozone, ground level ozone, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Is there significance that this research would take place in a prairie or prairie land that is nearby Lake Michigan shoreline?
Yeah, so we are actually stationed right now in what's called Chewaukee Prairie. It's a national reserve. And really why we want to be at this site is because we are directly on the lakeshore. I mean, I'm outside right now and I can look to my east and I see the lake, right? So that's important because, like I was saying, that lake breeze circulation where, you know, you have all that nice lake air that comes on the shore, you want to be in that circulation. If you go too far inland, right, you don't really have that lake breeze effect. So let's say if the dominant wind direction during the day is from the west, right?
Mm-hmm.
The land might just get westward wind, but if you're on the lake and you have a nice lake breeze, you can have winds at the surface coming from the east, right? So that's what's unique about it, because if you have that Chicago plume that I was talking about over the lakeshore and you have winds coming from the east, now you're blowing all that pollution on shore. So that's why it's important to be at this site, because it gives us a really nice view of if we get that lake breeze effect and what's in the plume when it comes onto the shoreline.
Does that pollution ever get trapped out on the lake with the different types of wind patterns and just hovers over the lake? Does it disperse there or does it eventually reach land?
Yeah, so it all is about the meteorology, right? So if the pollution is too far out in the center of the lake, right, It's not going to really travel into land because the lake breeze, you know, it's really reserved for the shoreline and just a little bit past the shoreline over the water, right? You need that sharp temperature gradient to form the lake breeze, right? The land, it likes to absorb all that solar radiation, heats up the air rises, and then you have that cool lake air. So when your air rises, your cool lake air then comes in to take the place of the warm air that rises. So that's why you get that nice circulation. So if you're too far out over the water, right, you don't have that land temperature gradient to form those that lake breeze. So there's really not a lake breeze if you're out in the center of the lake. So it's really important to be close, right on the shore, and that's where all the action happens.
You've brought up the Chicago effect, the Canadian wildfires as an influence to ground level ozone as well. If ozone pollution exceeds safe limits set by the Environmental Protection Agency and its source can be identified, is it possible the polluters would be held accountable in some way?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah. So that's one of the main goals that the EPA was set out to do when it was first founded, is to say, to set these limits and to determine who is the polluter and say, hey, you got to lower your emissions. But it's a little bit more difficult in this time and age, right? Because like I said, we're on the shoreline and, you know, we say, oh, the Chicago plume is coming over the lakeshore. Well, what do we mean by that? Is that a particular power plant? Is that a collection of people just sitting in traffic, right, waiting for work? Is it the whole, downtown city district, their total emissions that are coming, you know, off the city? So it's a little difficult to try to find, well, who is the main polluter, right? You can't punish a whole city or a whole group of people sitting in their car for work. So really, that's our first goal, is to determine if we could find some sort of way to, you know, reduce the emissions. But our second goal, of course, is to understand the science. Is there something we can do as a population to increase our ability to know about air quality, to both save people's health, right, and to see if we can also measure enough of this to understand the chemistry to forecast when it's going to happen in the future, right? Mm-hmm. If I can predict an air quality event 5 days out, right, you can better be prepared, right? You can tell people to stay inside.
You can make plans. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So, yeah, to answer your question again, it's a difficult question, right? When you talk about, you know, putting regulations and making people who pollute do it less, it's hard to do that because you really don't know, especially in this case along the lakeshore, who is the main cause. You just know it's a larger area, right?
Todd McKinney, graduate student in a project called the Rocket City Ozone Quality Evaluation in the Troposphere, based at University of Alabama in Huntsville, which is one of the scientific partners in an ozone monitoring project underway in southeast Wisconsin and over Lake Michigan. Call in with a question or a comment along the way, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Department of Natural Resources partners with universities on a project underway in Kenosha County gathering air samples to better understand pollution sources. The DNR says areas along Wisconsin's Lake Michigan shoreline have historically logged elevated quantities of ground-level ozone. Join in at any point about air quality monitoring. Call in with a question, a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. University of Alabama in Huntsville graduate student Todd McKinney is here, works on the Rocket City Ozone Quality Evaluation in the Troposphere, which is involved in this project over southeast Wisconsin. Todd, the ozone monitoring project builds on this 2017 study in the area. What more are you hoping to learn years later?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the one thing that's different about what we're doing now is we have the ozone LIDAR, okay? So the ozone LIDAR is a really important tool because instead of just getting surface level ozone, right, like you would with a standard EPA station or an aircraft, you know, that takes ozone measurements, it can only take measurements over a certain area, like It has to go back if it wants to measure over the same location. The ozone LIDAR gets you a profile of the whole atmospheric column around 0 to 10 kilometers in the troposphere every 2 minutes over one location. So that's a big deal, right, when you're talking about lake breeze ozone. Because if you have ozone that's coming off the lake and it's coming towards the land, you have to realize, well, when does the ozone, the higher ozone concentrations, get to the surface? That's what we care about, because that's where everyone's breathing, right? We care about if the high level ozone stays aloft and if the high level ozone comes down, right? And we're starting to breathe it. So the ozone LIDAR, now that we have this tool, is going to allow us to pair it with our meteorological data to understand if the ozone is going to stay aloft or it's going to come down in the lake breeze circulation. So that's something that's going to shed a little bit more light compared to what the 2017 study, it didn't have the ozone LIDAR. So it's a big step for understanding ozone along the lakeshore.
It sounds like it's also, you know, instead of a little snapshot here and there, you get a much bigger, broader picture of an area. Is that
yes.
what LIDAR can help do?
Yes, exactly. So it's a great tool to understand ozone in the vertical, right? The aircrafts, right, and the drones and the balloons are a little better in doing measurements in the horizontal, we call them. So the LIDAR, it all kind of comes together to make a big picture, because the LIDAR gets your profile over one location and your aircraft measurements get your horizontal over a larger location. So we call it a nice time and spatial analysis that allows us to combine all these measurements to tell the story, right? Because that's really our goal as scientists, is to tell the story on the air quality and to understand if this happens again in the future, what's going on and how can we better prepare.
Let's bring in Tom in Green Bay. Tom, what would you like to ask?
Yeah, so I had a question about whether there are different isotopes of ozone, similar to how there are different isotopes of carbon dioxide that help research determine where the source of carbon dioxide came from, whether it's from, like, vehicles, factories, or, you know, volcanoes. Are there different types of ozone that can be attributed to certain industries or factories even?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We don't typically, we just look at the base ozone. There's no, you know, isotopes. But what we also look at is the precursors to ozone. So we like to see, is NO2 high, right? Nitrogen dioxide. Is carbon monoxide high? If we have high carbon monoxide, we can say, oh, this might be from a biomass burning event, right? So instead of just looking at ozone, we also measure all sorts of different things, because those precursors we call primary pollutants then produce the secondary pollutant, ozone. So to understand ozone, you really need to understand first the primary pollutants to understand where it's coming from, right? If you have really very, very high NO2, that could be from a power plant, right? Or if you have very, very high CO, that could be from a biomass burning event, like a large fire that comes down. Or if you have very high particulate matter, which we saw 2 days ago, from the fires, that can also increase your ozone production. So the key is, to answer your question, it's more about looking for other things that produce ozone, your primary pollutants, when trying to identify sources.
Tom, thanks for the call. As we talk about ground ozone in Wisconsin, Todd McKinney is a graduate student at the University of Alabama in Huntsville and part of an ozone monitoring research project that is underway in southeast Wisconsin. You can join in with your question at 800-642-1234. Todd, there are multiple collaborators here on gathering these samples and doing this research. Can you talk a bit about who's doing what here? How is the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources on this project, and who are the other researchers involved?
Sure, yeah. So like you said, we have a lot of different universities that are all over the place. This is actually the Aegis Project, which is a collaboration between a lot of different university groups that is doing more than just the research in the Chicago area. Right now, a lot of our assets, especially the aircrafts, are actually over New York, flying and taking measurements. And then later, hopefully at the end of the month, beginning of next month, they're going to be up here. So they're hitting multiple different cities, right? It's not just one area. They're going to different areas. So specifically in Chicago, NOAA is one of the big collaborators. They have they're going to be flying one of the big aircraft, the DC-8, which has a lot of different instrumentation on this aircraft made from different universities, different government organizations. So they're all on the same aircraft, all taking data, which is a really, really cool thing to be able to say that we're collaborating that well. And then, of course, on the ground, we also have university ground assets like surface station monitors. We have people who are driving vehicles around. We have what these things called NASA Pandoras. Those are actually an asset from NASA that was funded to do column measurements. It's a spectrometer. So those are deployed all over the area. And then we also have a little smaller sensors, like there's a Purple Air Network, we call it, which does particulate matter and a lower cost that can be deployed over larger areas. So a lot of different universities and a lot of different agencies collaborating for one goal. It's really cool.
It sounds like a candy store for a scientist like you.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, these, you know, we have group meetings and everybody loves to talk about the science, right? It could go on for a long time. Everyone is so interested. And especially up in the Chicago area where you have this nice lake breeze and it's producing just a lot of great data that's going to be used in the future a lot.
Well, producing a lot of great data in the future, what can we who are not involved in the project expect in the months and years to come from this? What should we be watching for in our moments left here?
Sure. So the biggest goal, at least for the public side, is awareness, right? We talk about air quality, and you probably hear me getting so excited about these events. But in reality, these events lower the air quality, which, you know, affect people's health. Like, why am I getting excited about it? A lot of people ask that. Well, it's more about, well, how can we better prepare and how can we better inform the public when these events are going to happen? That is the number one goal. You know, the point of air quality research is to improve our air quality. So in the future, I would definitely look out for more agency collaboration for understanding when these exceedance days are happening, right? When we have all this research and all this data that shows when an exceedance day is going to happen, well, now we can better prepare and better inform the public. So hopefully from these campaigns and all this research that comes out, we have forecasters who are now equipped to understand the impacts of these air quality events on the public and to better inform the public and the goal. So that's the main goal, and hopefully that will happen in the future as we look at the data after.
Todd, thank you for joining us and taking us into this project.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on. It's been great.
Todd McKinney works on Rocket City ozone quality evaluation in the troposphere as a graduate student at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, part of an ozone monitoring project underway in southeast Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.